Behold the great warlord. Brilliant master of trickery. Who tricked his own loyal vassals into a noiseless smothering. Mina Shinu. Crimson fucking horse shit.
Welcome to Shogun, the official podcast. My name is Emily Yoshida, and I was a writer on the series. And after each episode, I dive deeper into the different elements that went into making Shogun with co-creators Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, along with the cast and crew that helped bring this story to life. This week, we're talking about Episode 7, A Stick of Time. As usual, this means that there will be spoilers for this and the previous six episodes, so consider yourself warned. On the podcast today, I'll hear about Torunaga's relationship with his son from actor Hiroyuki Sanada, how Gin laid the seeds for the geisha class with producer Eriko Miyagawa, and how the music for our show gets into the minds of our characters with composer Leopold Ross. But first, Rachel Kondo, executive producer and co-creator, joins us again to talk through just how pivotal this moment in our story is.
There's something dread-filled about this episode. You just have this sense that the other shoe is going to drop.
The tension and dread that fills this episode all comes back to Torunaga, who, as usual, is totally opaque when it comes to his feelings or plans.
There is a moment when Torunaga is in his contemplation. He is meditating as to what he's going to do, or so his advisors think. And everybody's waiting around, and we see this beautiful scene of Torunaga standing by a torii gate and doing not much. He's thinking. And the director of this episode, Takeshi Fukunaga, had a great idea for this moment, and he shared an anecdote about his childhood in Hokkaido, and he told us how kids used to throw stones up to the torii gate and make a wish. And it was just such a small, specific anecdote, I think is important to note simply because that was one of the ways in which we could bring in actual lived experience of our crew.
It's interesting that to hear its origin, because it's a childhood thing, you know, somebody's from somebody's childhood. And in a way, it kind of gives away how really at the end of his rope, Torunaga, you know, he's doing this very kind of almost superstitious act. This feels like the first time in our story where Torunaga is actually genuinely taken by surprise by something. It feels like this is genuinely not a part of his plan. And the fact that it comes from this family member feels especially cruel in some way or another.
Sayaki was the much younger half-brother of Torunaga. And he kind of always had it out for his brother because Sayaki was the lesser lord who basically was relegated to watching over the calm waters of Yuzenji. And he had a lot of time on his hands and he grew his most excellent ponytail out. And so, we have this freed up person who comes in and he doesn't have much to lose. So,
yeah. It feels like the kind of person who, you know, when they have a lot of time on their hands and you as Torunaga are not necessarily keeping a strong hold on that alliance, that's somebody who, you know, can go rogue on you.
Totally.
So Gin is somebody who's not nearly as close to Torunaga as somebody like Hiramatsu or even Buntaro, but she's been kind of watching him from afar, we can tell, and maybe seeing something in him that even those closest to him in his inner circle, they can't even see. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this very kind of game-changing scene between Torunaga and Gin.
This scene between Torunaga and Gin is one of my favorite scenes of the entire season of the show. The scene is played so beautifully by the actress Yuko Miyamoto, and every time I watch it, I'm riveted because I'm watching her eyes as she's pleading her case to Torunaga, and her eyes actually are filled with tears that never seem to fall. And I'm always wondering how you do that. But anyway, Gin seems to have kind of narrowed in on something it seems even his closest advisors and friends and son might have missed. And it perks up both Torunaga to her the case that she's pleading, but it also perks us up as an audience because maybe she is right. Maybe he does have a plan. Maybe, you know, we have no idea what is going on in his mind, but I do think that the character of Gin and the character of Torunaga share something in common that is pretty unique and special.
Yeah. They're both visionaries in a way that we can definitely see from the scene.
They're long, long gamers. I mean, it's quite an ask, you know? This is a man who is on the brink of kind of personal and political collapse. And here she says, let's set that aside and discuss my lifelong dream. And she presents this plan, which is basically the precursor to our modern understanding of the geisha. And she asks him to protect women in her line of work and to treat them as the artists that they are and for the art that they do and for the passion with which they put into their craft. And, you know, it's just this, you could see her as she watches that stick of time going out. You could see the ache in her. And she's pleading this case in front of a man who could snap his fingers and she be dismissed, killed, overlooked, as she always has been. You know, it's a really powerful scene.
So this episode ends with one of the more shocking moments, I think, in the series, with Nagakata's quite inglorious death. It does change the kind of structure of our series in a way, because it does ratchet up the stakes for Torunaga in a really specific way. This is his son. This is a huge loss in what's already a very dire situation. How do you think this changes Torunaga's plan, his strategy, or, you know, how does it affect how he sees his situation?
It's a great question, because he's trying to either survive or he's trying to accept and surrender to what is about to befall him. And we don't know. And no matter what it is, it's like you said, it's a very pressurized situation and the stakes are very high. And then all of a sudden, his son dies in this very, very terrible way. And it feels so pointless. And how do you hold up the whole of your plan / non-plan and also grieve, right? And it just feels like the world, or Torunaga's world as he knew it, is done.
Even before the tragic loss of his son, Torunaga is at a low point in this episode.
Episode 7 is one of the hardest part for Torunaga, right?
Yeah.
Almost like a bottom.
Back to discuss Torunaga's dashed hopes for his son is star and producer Hiroyuki Sanada.
Of course, Torunaga loves Nagakata. That's why he's trying to be hard to Nagakata as an education. So the young boy is always eager for everything, right? So maybe Torunaga tried to teach him patience. Torunaga see the possibility in his son, but not enough yet.
It feels like Nagakata, as his son, is sort of this one hope of a successor or an heir or somebody to see through his vision for Japan in case he's not able to see it through himself.
Yeah, very important for Torunaga, because if he created a new world, dreaming world, it can't be finished in Torunaga's generation. It have to continue.
Yeah.
Next
generation. Yeah.
So that's why important to teach him.
In addition to all the other producer duties that we talked about and consulting on everything, you also had a lot of input into the stunt performances as well, right? So what did that involve? I believe this episode has, you know, a good deal of fight scenes in it. Were you like there on set when combat was happening?
Before on set, during the rehearsal, or at that time, I gave them pointers about sword fighting or all other things. So many different weapons there on set, sword or naginata, spear. So all different way to use. So, of course, hard to them, for the young actors especially for the extras. And luckily, I had a great stunt coordinator, the Laurel, who was in The Last Samurai. We worked together.
Cool, yeah.
A long time. So he knows me. I know him very well.
Yeah.
So easy to communicate and then collaborate.
Yeah, and trust too.
Trust, yes.
You need that with a stunt coordinator,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Creation and safetiness, mm-hmm. both ways. And we had a great stunt guys too. But I loved all the process.
There's also such a scene I really love in this episode between Toranaga and Gin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting because saying there's so many people who are close to Toranaga, are working with him, but I feel like very few where I feel like they're almost Toranaga's equal in terms of like their minds, their vision for the future. And I love that scene because it shows somebody who is also thinking very far ahead about, you know, what her legacy is going to be. And you haven't really, you know, spoken to her before. This is almost like one of the first meetings, but it's such a kind of meeting of minds, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk about that scene and what Toranaga sees in Gin at that moment.
Another lucky thing for me,
mm-hmm.
I worked with her before, and then she graduated the same university.
Oh, wow. So way back.
way back.
Amazing.
So easy to communicate on set, of course. And also, I think Toranaga felt something similar in Gin. Mm-hmm. I believe she also strategist and something, you know, create something from the bottom, and then she became a top in her industry,
world.
Right?
Yeah.
And created a new world in the history until now. So maybe he failed, and maybe because he was in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But still wearing the armor, tried to keep his pride. Only her came into his mind and took off his armor.
Mm.
And then, wait, I forgot something. I have to be myself again now.
Yeah.
The Gin gave him something important. Medicine.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
During that one stick of time.
The one stick of time, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, because in a way, it's also just encouraging maybe to have somebody, everybody there is getting ready to dig their graves.
Yeah.
And she's not. And that's important.
And then people doesn't know who gave you great advice. Sometimes not parent, not friend. Not Hiramatsu. We are, you know, we can come back from the bottom, even one song or one movie.
Yeah.
You know.
Something unexpected.
That was Gin for Toranaga, I think.
Gin helped Toranaga recenter himself amid the turmoil around him with a vision of the future to match his own. But what is this vision Gin sees? What is this proprietor of a rural tea house building toward? When we see sex work depicted in Japanese historical fiction, we often only get a narrow look at the geisha system. But the history of courtesans and the evolution of their role in society goes back long before the Sengoku period. It was only in the years that followed, in the Edo period, that the idea of the geisha as we know it today was solidified. Gin speaks of that history in this week's episode during her Stick of Time with Toranaga. Gin is a forward thinker in our story. Set on the cusp of the Edo period, her work represents many customs that would have come in the following years and decades. Even the use of the incense to measure time was a relatively new practice for the era, a symbol of her eye toward the future. Courtesans in Japan had long been seen as more than just those who traded intimacy for money. Women like Kiku, Gin's most prized courtesan, had to be skilled entertainers, musicians, and dancers. Gin sees underutilized value in her courtesans, petitioning Toranaga for the creation of a guild in his new empire. This formalization of the profession would lead to the creation of the highly organized and hierarchical geisha class, and be the foundation of a rich cultural district in Edo, built on the skills of entertainers who brought their performance and artistry to the new city. The first sign of courtesans in Japanese history appeared in the Menyashu, an 8th century anthology of poetry. Like the tea house in Ajiro, courtesan groups had a clear structure. And in the Sengoku era, all these positions, chief, vice chief, would all be held by women. This would come to change in the Edo period, with men becoming involved and a more rigid structure for brothels being implemented. Regardless of what the future holds for her, Gin stands at an important turning point for her profession. And it's hard to imagine anyone standing in the way of her ambition. The tea houses were one way for a samurai to relax in Ajiro, but there was another feature of the region that you can still experience today.
Izu is known for awesome hot springs.
Producer Eriko Miyagawa returns to the podcast to take us inside the setting of some of the most tense moments in this episode.
Now, I think historically, you know, hot springs was known to have great medical benefit. So, you know, samurais would, you know, nurse their wounds or relax in hot spring. I think that was quite common. I do think it was quite common for people to make a trip and visit certain hot spring that is known for certain types of water.
So Saeki, as Toranaga's half-brother, is a lord in his own right, but it's also kind of clear that he sees himself as lower than Toranaga in some ways. And so I was kind of wondering about that relationship of half-sibling and how it worked, especially among the nobles and the samurai class, and how it affected, you know, your lineage and inheritance and all that kind of stuff. Was a half-sibling seen as lower? And yeah, just what would their relationship have been like growing up?
The big thing is, who is your mother, right? Mm-hmm. Is it the first consort, second consort, or, you know, somebody much lower? I think that played a big part. And also the first son, second son, the earlier you are, you know, most likely you're considered higher in rank. I don't know if Saeki and Toranaga had much relationship. They're quite far apart in age. And given that Toranaga was sort of pawned off as hostage from young age. But I'm sure Saeki grew up hearing all this, you know, this great story of this child, you know, war prodigy, Toranaga, and must have developed this great sense of insecurity and complex. So, yeah, this is his moment.
So I wanted to talk about the scene with Gin when she's having her meeting with Toranaga, which is where the episode gets its title from, A Stick of Time, which is just refers to the actual stick of incense that burns down and the conversation that they have during that time. It's a very important conversation on a character level, but it's also has a lot of significance historically. Gin is sort of talking about the life of a courtesan and what it would have been like in that era, still kind of in the Sengoku era. And it's different for sure from what we think of as geishas or what will be geishas and kind of what she's proposing in this conversation. So could you talk a little bit about that scene and this conversation and the significance it has?
Yeah, here Gin is planting a seed for what historically become Yoshiwara, which is an area in Edo, just Tokyo. I guess it could be translated as red light district, but it's, you know, it's a collection of tea houses and sort of licensed, controlled, protected, and taxed by Edo shogunate, Edo government. And that sort of protection allows for this culture that we now know, most famously for geisha, to really develop and to become refined. We pushed it a little bit on the show because I think, you know, in Sengoku period, I think we chose to portray Kiku as, and Gin, obviously, as sort of ahead of its time and very forward-thinking and sophisticated, which is something that happened, you know, a little bit later.
From characters like Gin, who look to the future, to Nagakado, who has his cut short, the moments of our show are often punctuated by music that speaks to what's going on inside these characters' minds.
I think it was a lot about scoring the psychology of scenes rather than the action.
Here to talk us through the music of our series is Leopold Ross, who, along with Atticus Ross and Nick Chuba, composed the score for Shogun.
Shogun is so much about what's unsaid, you know, and reading between the lines of the conversation. So as the music, I think one of the main roles of the music is to kind of score what's going on in someone's mind rather than what's coming out of their mouths.
I wanted to ask just about the opening theme, because now I feel like having watched as many episodes as we've been through, I really have it in my head now. And I've been thinking a lot about what it means and kind of the construction of it, because it really builds. We have this kind of cyclical thing. It really seems to tell a story. Can you get into that a little bit?
I mean, normally our process is when we sign on to do a project, we will typically have a conversation with the director or the showrunner, as we did, and we'll read the scripts, and we'll, you know, if they have a Bible or a lookbook, we'll kind of consume that information. And then before seeing any picture, we'll just write some ideas and then we'll send them. In this case, we sent it to Justin. And honestly, that was one of those tracks. We had never seen any picture or anything like that. That was just something that Nick had started, and then we developed it together. But it was something that Justin was really drawn to immediately. And he said, that's the theme, just straight out of the gate. He was like, this is it. And we changed the arrangement, and we got to a place where I think it's an incredibly epic opening theme. And I think the visuals are fantastic as well.
Yeah. It has such a kind of peaceful opening. And I think every single time the title itself comes up and there's that kind of wah-wah-wah sound, I'm like, yes, such a great build. So we're talking episode 7 this week, which is the episode where Torinaga's half-brother, Sayaki, basically has everybody hostage while they have them over to try to get him to join him for this Crimson Sky attack.
It's definitely a tipping point. Everyone's wavering in their belief that Torinaga knows what he's doing.
Which up until this point, it's really felt like whether he's fully showing his hand or not, Torinaga seems to have the big game in his mind. And this is the first time it feels like he really stumbles. Was there any kind of specific change you wanted to have for this turn of events or this act of the story?
The most important thing with this particular episode was, in a sense, matching, the visuals are incredibly atmospheric. There's so much mist going on from beginning to end in this episode. And a lot of it was about what is the sound of the mist, you know what I mean? And it was sort of creating that sound and also creating this kind of growing sense of dread as things unfold, because, you know, I think on the face of it, they're going to meet Saeki. That's his brother. It shouldn't be bad necessarily. You think that our heroes are safe there, but, you know, as we've come to understand in the world of Shogun, every man has his own agenda. And so it's sort of about having this sense of unease, I suppose, that grows throughout the episode.
Were there any musical moments in episode 7 specifically that you remember really loving?
I enjoyed creating the section where I call it Stories, Legends, and the Truth, because that's what Saeki says. It's a long section. It's a kind of essentially almost plays as a montage, but it starts when they're all having dinner. And Saeki says, hey, Nagakado, what do you like, stories, legends, or the truth? And I think the challenge there was sort of, again, having this sort of growing unease that sort of crossed different scenes. You have, obviously, the dinner scene, and then suddenly they're surrounded, and the guy comes in, and, you know, it unfolds of Saeki's turning against them. Then we cut away to Blackthorn and Mariko. Then we cut away to Torinaga contemplating. There's a lot of different scenes that this one piece of music covers. And it was sort of a lesson in minimalism and simplicity, because it's not a musically dense cue. It's really more about just this kind of insistent throb that goes on throughout the whole thing.
Right. And It's this plot point or like sequence, I guess, that really changes our idea of the kind of legend of Toranaga. So in this episode, we obviously have this whole ending sequence where Nagakado meets his untimely end. But I was wondering sort of what your general philosophy was around action sequences and how you kind of scored around the movement and the action.
There is a sort of common thread in a lot of movies and TV to have a consistent kind of thrumming, fast rhythm mm-hmm. in action scenes. And Justin was very clear that he did not want to do that, which is cool for us because we didn't necessarily want to do that either. So that took some experimentation and it really came together in the episode 2 Shinobi Attack. That's something that Nick actually put together, and it's almost plays like a horror cue. You know, there's a lot of space, and it's just about punctuating beats and then leaving the silence in between so that you can kind of feel the horror of what's actually going on. And the reason I bring that up is because that was a direct influence when you look at the end of episode 7.
I was going to say, yeah.
Nagakado's, that whole moment with Nagakado and Saeki, it's grown from that moment. The end of episode 2 kind of informed the way that we approached action from that point onwards, and the end of episode 7 is a good example.
That's all for this week's episode of Shogun, the official podcast. Next week, what awaits Toranaga in Osaka? Will the death of Nagakado change his strategy? And how long are his men going to be willing to follow him along his seemingly doomed path? Tune in next week when we discuss episode 8 of FX's Shogun. You can find a link in our description to episodes 1 through 7 of Shogun. And if you want to dive deeper into the world of our story, check out the official Shogun Viewer's Guide. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. Be sure to rate, review, and follow Shogun, the official podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Yoshida, and I'll see you next week.